Good morning, all. I'd like to call our meeting to order. There's a lot of good chatter going on here, and I actually hate to disrupt that. What we are doing today, we know we have a pollinator problem, and what we want to do is understand the depth, the scope of the problem, so the solutions that we put on the table actually meet the scope of the problem and that they're not window dressing. That is, of course, always a worry over here. So with that, I would like to call up our first witnesses about bee kills and pollinator decline, and we'll start with, I believe, three coming up at the same time. And on your agenda, Catherine Sill, Aaron Roop, Priscilla Allen. Welcome to the committee. And what you do is state your name first, and then you may begin.
My name is Catherine Sill. Christy Allen.
I'm Aaron Roop.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee, for the opportunity to speak to you today about this very important issue. 2 years ago, we moved to Minneapolis and bought a house in the Lowry Hill neighborhood. 1 year ago, I became a beekeeper. In order to practice this hobby, I had to follow a city-recognized course and obtain a permit. I had to get several permission signatures from my neighbors before I was able to get the permit. I paid $100 for it. My bees arrived on May 4th, 2013. All summer they thrived in our garden. I was mentored through a program at the U called the Bee Squad, and so had a visit about every 4 weeks with my mentor to check on my progress as a beekeeper and on my bees' health. It was a fantastic and endlessly fascinating summer. You're supposed to go into the hive only every 7 to 10 days to check on them, but there's no rule about watching them daily from the outside. I work out of my house, so when I took a break from work, I would go outside just to watch them coming in with different colored pollens or drawing nectar from the surrounding prairie garden we put them around them. By August, they had gathered and stored enough honey and pollen, about 100 pounds, in order to have enough to live on through the winter here, so I was able to put on a box to collect honey for us. It's called a honey super. I didn't expect to have a harvest in my first year because in a new hive, the bees have so much work to do to get that 100 pounds. So it was a nice surprise that they were so industrious and we had a harvest. On the morning of September 12th, we went to the Bee's Knees Honey House and used their great honey extracting bicycles to extract what turned out to be 3 gallons of honey. When we got home, I was heading back to the hive to put the sticky super back on. As I got to the hive, I saw thousands of dead and dying bees all over the ground. I immediately called the U. They came that day and again the next morning with the Department of Agriculture. They swabbed the outside of the hive as a control to check for direct sabotage of my hive. They took the dying bees and put them on dry ice to be sent off for testing. Once a bee is dead, it's nearly impossible to find out what killed it, so it's important to gather the dying ones. Rural beekeepers might not see their bees for days, so if they get there and the bees are dead, they have no way of finding out what killed them. One of the advantages of urban beekeeping is that you see them every day right out the window, which means you can have a quick enough response on a kill like this. On that same day, the bee squad discovered 2 other hives within a mile of mine had also been hit. We are so fortunate that the bee squad exists and that they could connect these events. I cannot stress enough how important it was for us to have a place to call for help. They knew what they were looking at and what they had to do to record and test it. At their own cost and from their timely efforts, we were able to find out exactly what killed these bees. The results came back a few weeks later. The bees were killed by a systemic pesticide called fipronil, which is supposed to be sprayed on foundations against termites, ants, and wasps, not on flowering plants where pollinators feed. Both pests and beneficial pollinators die from these applications. Any website that you look at about fipronil states that it is clearly highly toxic to honeybees. Depending on the application, fipronil can have a slow breakdown. Insects can be killed by it for up to 125 days, according to the National Pesticide Information Center. It has been brought to my attention that this product, while mainly used by commercial applicators, can be purchased online, except in New York, Connecticut, Alaska, and Massachusetts. Shouldn't Minnesota, with all of our pollinators, also be restricted? Also extremely disconcerting, the results of the swab of my hive show that it was covered in a fungicide called carbendazim, by some accounts a carcinogen. It also weakens bee larvae. Our garden is surrounded by a 7-foot fence, so the unintended consequence of people's careless spraying was twofold for us. First, the bees dying from eating poison nectar, and second, because of aerial drift, someone's fungicide application was so heavy it went over my 7-foot fence to cover my hive and likely my vegetable and flower gardens. These chemicals clearly have negative unexpected impacts as well as their intended ones. Needless to say, they should be used more responsibly. I believe responsible use should mean use by trained individuals and registered use and transparency, or the availability of records of their use. We need to make those negligent individuals accountable for their actions. If practices like these were in place, my bees might not have died. My enclosed garden might not have been contaminated. But even if they had been, we might be able to determine who used them, where, when, and how, so that we can improve the community's practices and take steps to provide a safer urban environment for our beneficial pollinators and our citizens. I immersed myself in this wonderful, healthy, needed hobby. I did everything right. Until the day my bees were exterminated, I enjoyed great success. When all this happened, I emailed my neighbors. I contacted the Parks Department, the city, and anyone else I could think of. No one sprayed. Unfortunately, because we lack basic controls and management of pesticide use, especially transparency, I don't know what application killed my bees and who contaminated my garden. More importantly, I have very little confidence that it won't happen again this year. That's why I'm here to ask for your help on this issue. I'll be an urban beekeeper again this summer because I know how important a healthy pollinator population is. Hopefully, I can do this with the confidence that our government is taking prudent, logical steps to ensure pollinator protection across our area. Thank you.
Thank you. Are questions for members before we hear from the next? Yes, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What purpose does that fungicide have that somebody sprayed?
Madam Chair, my understanding is the purpose of the fungicide is to get fungus off your decorative crab apples. So your decorative crab apples look pretty.
I don't see any other questions. Would you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing us to come today and share with the committee our story. My name is Christy Allen. This is my business partner, Aaron Root. Together, we run a small beekeeping business called the Bees Knees LLC. The Bees Knees is working for healthy bees and healthy lives through bicycle-delivered honey sales, education, beekeeper support services, and pollinator advocacy. Before we talk about the pesticide kill that we experienced last fall alongside Catherine and a third urban beekeeper named Mark Lucas, we would like to give you a brief history as to why and how the Bees Knees exists. In 2009, I went to work for my aunt and uncle at their commercial honey and pollination business in Squaw Lake, Minnesota. Before I even went to their ranch, I was certain I wanted to be a farmer someday, but had no idea how much I wanted to be a beekeeper until I stepped into a bee suit for the first time. I finally found something that filled me with passion. From that moment on, I was hooked and decided to learn as much as I could by reading books and picking his brain of 35 years' experience. Along the path of learning about beekeeping, I discovered the important role that honeybees and other pollinators play in our food system, and that they were dying, threatening not only the very passion I aim to pursue, but more importantly, something we all share, access to healthy food. In my second year at Barbell Bee Ranch, my aunt asked if I wanted to sell their honey in Minneapolis. A light bulb went off and a marketing idea was born that combined my new passion with an existing passion, bicycles. And it was a way I could tell the world that bees were in trouble. So in response to my aunt's question, I painted my bike black and yellow. On Halloween, I dressed to resemble a bee, effectively drawing attention to my business. I started delivering honey to people's homes and at farmers markets. I was a mobile advertisement not only for selling honey, but at the same time, drawing attention to bees and the fact that they were dying. In that first year, I learned something very important. People wanted to know about bees and why they were dying. I realized quickly we needed to educate. That year, I met educator Aaron Roop on a farm near Stillwater where we were both keeping our own hives. We started talking about the need for education, especially for kids and adults who live in the city and are disconnected to their food. She had a really great idea to bring kids and adults into hives, give them hands-on experience we both love so much as a way to do that very important connection work. We received a grant from Hennepin County Environmental Services through the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund as recommended by the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. We bought some bee suits and were gifted some equipment from Man Lake. We placed hives at urban farms, community gardens, and schools and started teaching classes in and around Minneapolis. We did education events all over the Twin Cities at places like the State Fair, the Pollinator Party, local schools, and many more. In 2013, we grew to managing a total of 50 hives between urban sites and rural farm sites. After our second year of delivering honey and teaching classes, we realized we needed a space of our own. Saw an opportunity to serve the rapid growth of hobby beekeepers. So in April 2013, we raised $40,000 to open the Bee's Knees Honey House, a place we could do our day-to-day operations, as well as a place for other beekeepers to use and build our community around beekeeping. In August of 2013, we extracted over 2,000 pounds of honey by bicycle. Then, in September of 2013, we experienced this bee kill. Before I transfer the floor to Aaron, who will share with you more about the bee kill and why we are here today, I would like to say one last thing. When I started the Bee's Knees 4 years ago, I could have never imagined that it would lead me here. When I started, all I knew was that I wanted to make a living as a beekeeper. What I didn't know when I started was that in order to be a beekeeper these days, you need more than books, uncles with 35 years of experience, clever marketing ideas, or a supportive community to be successful. You need to ask your government to help protect you from pesticides.
Questions, Member Brophy? I don't see any questions. Why don't you continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for having us today. I'm Erin Roop, the other half of the Bee's Knees. As Christy said, one thing we do is offer in-hive experiences to connect people to bees. Have you ever been in a beekeeping suit? Have you ever worked a hive before? Anybody? Who in the room? It's really, really fun. It's empowering, and it's an amazing learning opportunity, which is why we do it with second graders and high schoolers and everybody. Honeybees are an incredible teaching tool, and they provide a direct point of connection for students to learning, to science, to other subjects like math and social studies and history. And with honeybees pollinating a third of everything we eat, our fruits, our vegetables, our nuts, they provide a direct connection between students, and in our case, urban students, and agriculture. With our hive that was killed was at Blake School, and we were working there with high school students who were then teaching third graders. So these pictures are from that experience. This is our hive that was killed. It's extremely sad to lose those bees and these class opportunities this fall and spring. It was extremely sad to see those bees dying. As a business, we lost the revenue we would generate from those classes and from the honey those bees would produce. But it was also pretty lucky that we caught them as they were dying, that we live in the same town as the U of M Bee Lab and Bee Squad. These are folks who know what a pesticide kill looks like, how to sample bees, and where to send them to find out what killed them. And they're available as a resource to help. We need the U of M Bee Lab, which you all have the opportunity to support this bonding session, and we're urging you to do so. Out of our investigation, we now know, as Catherine mentioned, that structural and landscape pesticide applications kill bees. We now know that a systemic pesticide, though not a neonicotinoid, likely applied legally, kills bees. We also learned that state law preempts our ability to protect our bees from pesticides in our city. We launched the Healthy Bees, Healthy Lives campaign with other beekeepers, business owners, politicians, and citizens with scientific expertise from the Bee Lab and Bee Squad in response to this kill we experienced. We're connecting people to individual action steps for pollinators, planting flowers and eliminating pesticide use on their lawns, asking nurseries and hardware stores if plants are pre-treated with neonics, and urging people to talk to you to share their concerns for pollinators. Because we need more than individual action steps to address problems like this kill. Many people share our concern. We had a packed room at our campaign launch. Over 300 people have signed our pledge to not use pesticides in their backyards. These folks over here, everyone you see with a Healthy Bees, Healthy Lives button, these are concerned people, people who are supporting the work that we're doing and the work that you can do. We're asking for concrete things from you. Transparency. I'll number them. One, transparency in pesticide applications, so making applications records public, so both as Driftwatch does pre-spray, and then as the state of California does post-spray. Number two, labeling pesticide products that kill bees, making it easier for the consumer to make informed choices. Number three, forming a pollinator response team moving forward. If another kill does happen, being better equipped to be able to enforce laws and protect livelihoods like ours. Number four, restricting the sale of fipronil, as Catherine mentioned, as New York, Connecticut, Arkansas, and Massachusetts have, which on its label requires a license to apply, but is available online. And number five, reconsidering the preemption law for non-agricultural pesticides so smaller governing bodies could have some autonomy in pollinator protection. Historically, Minnesota has been an amazing state to be a beekeeper. We have been one of the top honey-producing states in the country. The largest beekeeping supply company in the world is based in Hackensack. We are the state where beekeepers brought their bees to eat to be healthy. We're also known as a state that cares about our ecosystems. We have large communities of hunters, of fishers, of farmers. We have 10,000 lakes. We have the boundary waters. A growing number of your constituents are beekeepers. Your constituents are farmers, they're gardeners, they're enjoyers of ecosystems with flowers, and all of your constituents are eaters, guaranteed. Christy and Catherine's ability to keep her bees where she wants to keep them, and Christy and my livelihood depends on you expanding your good work for pollinators to include our recommendations on pesticides. So maybe you care about us and make decisions to stop a kill like this from happening again, but just as likely you care about your constituents and your families. You have the direct ability to help pollinators continue to provide the fruits and vegetables and nuts that make up a nutritious diet that we all need to be healthy, that we all need in order to have livelihoods. We know that pollinators need our help, and this pollinator habitat bill that you'll hear from the next speakers about, it's such an important first step. We as beekeepers, as business owners, as people who eat, as proud Minnesotans, we would love to see Minnesota continue to be a national leader on this issue. And you all have that capability. I want to applaud you for the amazing work that you've already done and the work you'll continue to do. We'll be submitting all of our testimonies into written record, as well as a letter from Mark Lucas, who is the third beekeeper who experienced the kill. Thank you all so much for having us today.
I appreciate that you're going to give written testimony. We will post it on our website, which is our normal practice, and so that people can access that easily. And there will be the audio that they can listen to. So you can tell people that that's one of the ways it can be shared. And it's very easy. You go up to the Minnesota House of Representatives, committee information, just click on our committee, and there it's all there. Okay. So that this will be there, as well as the information from the meeting we had in October. So with that, members, questions or comments at this point? I think you have given us some very heavy things to think about. So I think we'll go through the rest of the testimony, and you'll be available throughout the hearing.
Yeah, absolutely.
That we'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Next on our agenda is Manly Bigalk from Golden Ridge Honey Farm. Welcome to the committee. We appreciate your being here.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Manly Biak. I'm from Cresco, Iowa. I've been a commercial beekeeper for 52 years, and I've also farmed for 52 years. I keep honeybees in Minnesota, and that's basically why I was asked to participate in this program. And to give a little background, I'm a member of the Corn Dust Research Consortium, which just basically published its results after the last year of research at Iowa State, Ohio State, and at Guelph. And it sounds like there will be a continuation of this program going into the next year. And there was, it was basically, the program was basically funded by Bayer and Syngenta, and it was made up of two beekeepers, some implement companies, and some researchers. And I don't want to take up a lot of time to explain all aspects of what the research came out, but it was primarily dealing with neonicotinoids and what effect the corn dust was going to have on blooming plants in the area. Now, for those of you that are involved in agriculture, you realize that we have new generation corn planters out there, and you also realize that we're applying neonicotinoid to the seed of corn seed. And it is a blanket application. You cannot order seed in the United States without neonicotinoids on the seed. And with our new planters, because the seed is placed so heavily, or the material is placed so heavily on the seed, it needs talc to lubricate it through the planting system on air-driven units. And when the air drives the seed back to the planting units, that air pressure needs to be voided. And when it's voided, it's voided into the atmosphere, and it's found to have neonic presence along with the talc. And so this research basically involved itself to determine how much, how far, and what was the results of this airborne material. And Iowa State, Mary Harris, conducted her research there, and she basically found that in a two-week period, all the blooming flowers, trees, plants around the cornfields had turned into a toxic area. They were this fine microfine dust. It can blow for 3 or 4 miles, and when you've got wind and dry condition, it adds to the lethalness and the drift of the material. And to get my testimony correct here, I'll just go into one other thing. I'm also involved in the National Honeybee Advisory Board. It's a group of 7-8 people from across the nation that try and keep up with the pesticide issues. And I'm a member of the American Beekeeping Federation, a national organization, and I've also used a crop consultant for our crops from Minnesota, from Mankato, an independent crop consultant. But back to the dust issue, the neonics were started to really be applied probably back in 2003-2004. In 2006 was when there was major uses of these materials. Well, 3 years ago, for the first time in our lifetime, which should have been 49, 50 years, we did come up with a bee kill. And this screened beehives that you see here is a typical commercial beekeeping or bee yard, made up of 32 colonies in a yard. These happen to be individual colonies. This is right at corn planting time. We had a condensed corn planting season, interrupted with weather. When the corn planters started to roll after that, they moved over a lot of acreage, so we seem to have come up with a saturation of the material. This is another bee yard. This shows a migratory setup, four colonies on a pallet. This is typically the kind of hives that you see moving into pollination areas, because we can load them and unload them with forklifts, put them on flatbeds, screen them, and colonies like this are also used in almond groves in California, which is in full swing right now. There you see a comb of brood that's set in front of the hive. That brown cell material you're seeing, that's where adult bees are emerging. They're chewing through that capping and emerging. This brood area needs to be kept at 90 degrees. The way bees do that, or 93, the way bees do that is with lots of bees generating heat, and they keep it from chilling. As you look at the front of the hive, you will see that windrow of dead bees, the bottom being that major entrance during the spring, summer, and fall, and that being closed up, and then the upper entrance being used in the winter time, if you're wondering what that auger hole is above. But I suffered loss in of bees during a three or four day period in front of every single hive, in every single yard, in 2.5 counties. And again, we had never experienced any kind of bee loss that was of this nature. Again, you're seeing dead bees in front of the hive. This is a little closer look. If you look real close at the screen, you'll see several bees that are a little larger. Those are drones. Those are the ones that are responsible for mating with the queen. Even they succumbed to what had occurred. Now these to many people are honeybees, and they certainly are, but they're our workers. And Whole Foods did a presentation some time ago showing in their larger display areas what would happen if the honeybee was removed from its pollination services, and 52% of the store wound up empty. And I'll let you read into this what who's standing there is thinking. When we go back to the sustainability of honeybees, if I can explain this properly, if we lose over winter, let's say, 5-8% of the colony numbers, we have the ability to go to the colonies that have lots of bees, lots of brood, and divide and remove some of that brood, and by adding a queen, we can fill up that empty slot. It will not be as productive that year, because bees' productivity is geared on numbers. We need the numbers in the hive to generate the pollination, the honey gathering, whatever it's needed. So that's how bees sustain losses. That, and they can also order bees, but ordering bees for commercial beekeepers is very expensive. Given the numbers needed and sizable losses. So, as we get back to losses we've experienced since 2006, Dr. James Fraser out of Penn State came up that since 2006, America lost, colonies died, 5.6 million colonies of bees. And much of it was due to influences that are very, very hard to determine. But neonics seem to be heading the list. Now, we ordinarily only have 2.5 million colonies of bees in any one given year. And 1.6 million of those colonies are being used right now in the almond groves in California. And they're pollinating the largest cash crop that agriculture produces in California. So you can see the sustainability of honeybees is really being challenged by these influences that are very, very difficult for us to control. They come from regulation that is regulation during the time of application on the seed, but after that it's basically unregulated. So for instance, as a farmer, you can plant a field, have something come up, either crusting or whatever, need to replant that field again, and so you pull through again, and with the neonics that are on the seed, you have doubled the amount of neonics that are going to be in the soil. And research has shown that these materials are lasting 3 to 4 years at a minimum in the soil. And only about 3% of the material is becoming systemic and going up into the plant and giving protection against harmful insect activity. So you've basically got another 97% that has been unaccounted for. And when the neonics were brought forth to EPA, they never went through the full protocol that was required. They were put on a certain classification and were allowed out into the market. Well, about 3 years ago, a petition circulated through the United States that was widely signed demanding EPA keep up on its protocol. They received the petition and said, well, in 4 or 5 years, we will act on this. Now, with 97 million acres of corn being planted last year in the United States, and taking out the organic corn that was planted, the rest of it was a blanket form on the seed of neonics. Myself, as a farmer, I could not order seed without neonics on it. And I find that very unusual because, by and large, I think with an integrated pest management thing, determining you do not need this amount of material applied to your seed, I would think would be a reasonable approach for us to go to. In other words, this blanket application of these materials are affecting not only honeybees, they're affecting all of our pollinators. And the research through this consortium has definitely shown that. And we'll continue going down this road with the University of Guelph also being part of the consortium's grant funding. They branched out and found that there was water contamination in the pothole area that comes down from Saskatchewan through the Dakotas, through Manitoba, through Minnesota, and into Iowa. The nicotinoid levels after corn planting season were escalating enough in the water, to affect and take away the water quality levels that we want. So again, this is kind of the center of my talk, and I don't want to take up too much time. It can go on and on, and it's amazing. I'm a beekeeper, I'm a farmer, I'm not a chemist, I'm not a scientist, but as you gradually find out this information that's out there, it's been out there, and you know it is not really evaluated for what it really is. Europe has 400 to 500 chemicals that they use. Here in the United States, we have 1,200, and there's so many 18,000 formulas that can be used with these compounds. And as I get back to the farming aspect, because I represent fifth generation farming, represent second generation beekeeping, I don't see any reason why pesticides and beekeeping can't be side by side like they were historically. And there were problems, but nothing like what we're coming up against today. And if we measure DDT as being a one, some of our new compounds are 5 to 6 to 7,000 times stronger than the original DDT was coming up. So it just seems like if we aren't going to get regulation out of Washington, and it doesn't seem very promising, it's probably going to have to get down to the state level. And so with that, I will, Madam Chair, take questions.
That would be good. Are there questions for members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Not really a question, just a I came across an article this past winter in an agricultural magazine I get relating to what the testifier was talking about, the dust on in corn planting. And I had some copies drawn off. It relates to a new lubricant that would reduce the dust as the corn is being planted. Would you mind if we could pass these out to committee members?
Absolutely. Okay. And we'll post it too.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If I could address that, in the Corn Dust Consortium, a new lubricant was used, and hopefully that it was going to cut the dust down. And what we found, it did cut it down by 22%, but it increased the toxicity of the dust.
That's important to hear. We'll start with Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I'm not a farmer. So I have some questions that maybe others are better informed about. Is there an alternative, an appropriate alternative, to applying this material to the seeds so that we wouldn't have that problem? There must be an alternative somewhere that we could do. What do we need to do to make that different?
Representative Ward, Madam Chair, yes, there are. And some of them are so common sense that one of the things we could do is we could control that dust. And because the dust from the corn planters is being emitted in a small manifold at the back of the planter, each row having a manifold. Well, with the knowledge and ingenuity of our machinery manufacturers, I'm sure that they could create either a tube that would cause this dust to enter into the tilled surface, underneath the tilled surface in the planting row, or they could be put up with a filtration unit, I'm searching for the right word here, just to filter the material out that would be interchangeable or whatever, but that has not been acted on. And I think, again, going back to the farm side of us, I know that we need protection in certain situations from harmful insect activity. But it seems to be this over application is what's putting us in trouble. In other words, 2 years ago, I showed up with aphids in my soybeans, which are a common threat, the aphid. And with advice of my crop consultant, as we walked the fields, we determined that probably it needed to be sprayed. And I'm failing here. I cannot remember the material we used to spray it. We put an aerial application on, but it was old compound we'd used for aphids, because aphids are not ordinarily that tough. And but to save the soybean crop, we applied it. We had a great kill on the aphids. I went back in the field 5 days later and found adult Asian lady beetles actively feeding on remnants of aphids. Well, this, my problem was solved, and still I hadn't put through this killing scene on the field. Now, obviously, it doesn't always work out that way, but this was the best side. And again, on the corn seed, I think we should have it so that you have the eligibility of buying corn seed without the materials on. And that using integrated pest management to determine if you have an elevated level of wireworms, of white grubs, things that the neonics suppress, you know, if you have that levels, then apply it. If you don't have it, let's keep it in the sack. We have any farmers here? Great.
Okay. We have more questions here. Did you have a follow-up?
No.
Okay. The next is Representative Erickson, and then Representative Keel.
Well, I guess that was the thank you, Madam Chair. I guess you kind of touched on it a little bit, the problem that the neonicotinoids were supposed to correct, and that's the two larvae or insects that you're talking about, yeah. Aphids or whatever. So if we don't have these, what the... Your options are to spray the whole field. You're saying if you need it, not is that not a certainty that you will need some kind of a spray application? And are these not found to be harmful to the bees? I'm just asking.
Soybean seed can be treated with neonics, and then supposedly become systemic and give prevention for aphids. Well, treated seed, not treated seed, it all seems to show up with aphids anyway. Am I making myself clear that it isn't preventing aphid activities, even though it's deemed to be protection from it? It is not always effective on stopping aphid activity. So then it's necessary to put down an application of it, just like what I described. This material that killed aphids and then was not toxic enough to prevent beneficial insect activity in the field afterwards.
Thank you.
Am I making myself clear? Maybe not.
I grew up in a farm area, but I did not grow up on a farm, so I guess I'm comfortable with that.
Representative Keel, and then I think we have a lot of other testifiers, and I hope you can listen to the rest of the testimony that's coming up. Representative Keel.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for coming. I actually have my husband's family started down in Cresco, Iowa. So I find that interesting. But anyway, they moved up to the Red River Valley, and I farm up there. I had the privilege of going to the University of Minnesota Northwest Experiment Station meetings this year with the farmers, and heard all the experiments that they're doing and success in crop management. And what I found very interesting was we talked about insecticides. This happened to be on aphids. We were in a soybean field. And, you know, on our farm, my husband waits until the absolute last minute because pesticides are not, you just don't want to have to, A, spend the money, and B, spend more time going over the field. Anyway, the recommendation generally was to spray aphids at, I believe, 250 aphids per plant.
Yes.
However, the university was telling the farmers to hold off. Don't do it at that point, because they were discovering if they waited till they were 300, between 300 and 400 aphids per plant, that that was when the Eurasian beetles came in and took care of it. So there were earlier recommendations to do it earlier, and now there's kind of, they said, you know what, you don't want to get to 600 because then the beetles can't handle it. But, you know, when I spent time with the experiment station, I find that we are right along moving toward how do we manage it and not be able to, use any more chemical than we absolutely have to. And Madam Chair, my concern is we're hearing one point of view, but I would like to know from the Department of Ag and also university studies where we're going with these things, because I believe that we're constantly trying to change things, and we've moved even discussing putting neonicotinoids on the seed. I know that there's already, as Representative Anderson said, they're already working on trying to do some different things so we aren't creating the dust. And actually, as a, you know, when I think back at my farming experience, because I grew up on a farm also, the stuff that we used back 20 years ago is entirely different from what we're doing now. We just really are just moving with protection to not just our farmers and our own fields and our product, but for our friends and neighbors who are purchasing those products. Thank you.
Representative Heel, the Department of Agriculture is on our agenda, but secondly, I think from my point of view, this testimony very much supports Representative Falk's bill to get an Institute of Plant and Pest Management at the U and to do some funding for that. That, remember, we had our testimony earlier, and we were talking just about things invading from the outside, and then it became clear that we needed to address agriculture pests at the same time, and he has expanded. He's, I don't think he's here right now, but I can tell you he has expanded the language in the bill to be more inclusive of agriculture pests. So I think the testimony helps us in that direction, too.
Madam Chair, I would just caution that we make sure that we look at all the research that we have, because I know there is different areas, and we may already have a lot of that going on.
Well, the department will be up, and thank you so much for your testimony. I totally appreciate your coming and making the trip. We do have lots of other things on our agenda, and we do need to go fast now, but I think that was very important testimony. Dr. Eric Rundquist, Minnesota Zoo, will what we're trying to do is kind of lay out the problem here, and then we will start hearing about the solutions. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Yeah, I am Eric Rundquist. I am the butterfly conservation biologist at the Minnesota Zoo, the state zoo, by the way. I'm going to talk to you quickly about the status of butterflies in the state of Minnesota. We have about 150 species that have been recorded in the state, about 20 times as many species of moths, but we know next to nothing about the distribution and the abundance of moths in the state of Minnesota. Butterflies and moths are certainly pollinators. Bees are more effective in many ways, but the sheer abundance of many species of butterflies and moths can certainly have an impact. And for example, one of the endangered plants in the state of Minnesota, the Western Prairie Fringe Orchid, can only be pollinated by hawk moths, and there's only two or three species known in the world of moths that can pollinate this endangered plant. It's a truly magnificent plant. The state of Minnesota currently has one species that's currently on the U.S. Endangered Species Act, the Karner Blue, that may have gone extinct in the state of Minnesota in the last few years, pending some further evaluation. Two other species were recently proposed for addition to the state endangered species, or to the federal Endangered Species Act. The Bowsheik skipperling is endangered, and the Dakota skipper is threatened. Both of these in the last 6 months were proposed. Much of what we know about the state of butterflies and moths in the state of Minnesota is due to the long history of work by the Minnesota DNR, and the state has been undergoing evaluations on the species of greatest conservation need, as well as reevaluating the state's endangered species list. There are currently 31 butterflies and moths that are being evaluated for addition to this list. But only five native species of bees, and so there's a really huge data hole for the state of native bees. Native bees certainly play a massive role in our pollination systems, not only for agricultural interests, but really every other wild flowering plant out there. So these are not only corresponding with the lack of or loss of habitat and associated threats, but also just the general lack of data from the state of many of these species. So we need strong support for these sorts of surveys. As many of you know, the state of Minnesota's historic prairie is quite sad. There's only about 1% of its original 18 million acres, which is here in yellow. Only 1% of that is remaining, these little red fragments scattered and now highly fragmented throughout the state. And this is not just the Minnesota problem, it's an upper Midwest, and it's a whole Midwestern problem. These native prairies stretch for thousands of miles, and we owe the really productive agricultural lands that we rely on now, those soils were produced by these native prairies. And that this fragmentation is a real problem for butterflies and moths and many other small insects like bees that have a really poor dispersal ability. So now we must think about each remaining prairie fragment as an island with its own problems. And so connecting these dots through the Minnesota Prairie Conservation Plan is a really substantial gain, and we can really benefit a lot of these species. So I encourage you to support that plan. Not surprisingly, then, there are many species of butterflies that are known to be imperiled, and many of these are also prairie endemics. So there are 15 species of butterflies and butterflies that are on the state endangered species list or threatened or special concern, and 10 of these are associated with prairie. So 2/3 of the butterflies in the state of Minnesota that are in trouble are prairie associates. The Dakota Skipper, which was recently proposed for federal threatened status and is Minnesota endangered, was quite common in Minnesota, had about half of the historic range, maybe a little less, but certainly a lot of individuals. It now is likely extinct in Illinois and Indiana, or Iowa, excuse me. And in Minnesota, we now only have observed them in one location in the last few years. And so it's many of these blue triangles in the historic range, about half of them are no longer extant either. So while we had great populations, the Dakota Skipper is hanging on by the edge of its range in Minnesota. There may have been an additional sighting in far northwestern Minnesota this year, but we can't confirm it yet. The Powhatan Skipperling is the most Minnesotan of all butterflies. The monarch is the state butterfly, and monarchs have had substantial declines, and they rely on the upper Midwest for much of their breeding range. But the Powhatan Skipperling had half of its historic range in the state of Minnesota, and we had the majority of all individuals. And that's a greater concentration in Minnesota than any other butterfly in the world. So this is really our butterfly. The problem is it has not been confirmed in the state of Minnesota for now 7 years. It disappeared. It used to be one of the most abundant species on Minnesota's prairies and is now potentially extinct, pending a little more work in the next few years. But it's also gone extinct, importantly, also, as far as we can tell, in North and South Dakota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana. And so 95% of the range is now gone for this once very common and predictable butterfly. And what we're left with are these tiny populations on the periphery of the range in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Manitoba, just over the U.S. border. And there's no chance that these butterflies are ever going to be able to see each other in these disparate populations. So we're really talking about individual populations with their own problems again. Extensive surveys in the last year found very few individuals. They had declined probably 75% from the previous year. Census population at all of these remaining populations globally under 200, under 150 probably. So we're likely, if we add in some error, talking about 500 individuals or less of this formerly extremely common butterfly. And this collapse occurred really around the early 2000s. So it was rapid, and potentially corresponding with the application of some of these pesticides we're talking about today. So the Powhatan Skipperling then must rank as one of the most endangered species on Earth. There are probably 3 to 4 times as many wild pandas in the wild as there are Powhatan Skipperlings. So it's a really dramatic decline. In recognition of that, the Minnesota Zoo and the Department of Natural Resources and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and many other agencies launched the Prairie Butterfly Conservation Program at the Minnesota Zoo in early 2012. Again, many, many partners, and an international partnership as well with partners in Manitoba and tribal partners in South Dakota. We've been funded to date entirely by the Legacy Amendment, but we now have recommendations under the LCCMR funding, pending its approval, for further expansion of our work we are seeking to establish conservation breeding programs of these endangered species to serve as a backup that may serve as a reservoir for potential reintroductions if we can have some sort of confidence that the wild populations could stick again. So we're facilitating field surveys. The Minnesota DNR and their portion of our joint LCCMR proposal will be doing field surveys for prairie butterflies quite intensively. I'll be doing population genetics surveys and studies at the Minnesota Zoo. And then pairing also with that is pesticides research, focusing on the effects of some of these neonicotinoids on butterflies. We have next to no knowledge about the effects of neonicotinoids on butterflies, especially in a wild context. So it's a dramatic need. And then finally conducting a substantial amount of outreach and using the Minnesota Zoo as the state's largest environmental educator. And one of those fabulous opportunities this summer is our Big Bugs exhibit, where we're going to be bringing in huge animatronic arthropods and tying in a live insect collection, and then really especially tying in pollinator and butterfly issues and prairie issues and conservation issues around that. So really trying to focus in on this and the plight of pollinators. But again, we don't want to make this just about these highly endangered butterflies. We want to be thinking about what's happened to these butterflies in the landscape and using them as indicators of what has happened. So, and thinking about the greater context, given that the Poweshiek skirpling was so common 2 decades ago and now is on the edge of global extinction. We need to think about butterflies and moths as excellent indicators. They have very complex life cycles, and they require different resources at different times of the year and different life stages. And so if we're thinking about habitat protections for these butterflies, we need to not just think about the floral resources. We need to think about the other half of the equation. We need to think about what the caterpillars are using and what they're feeding on, because oftentimes the adult resources and the caterpillar resources are relying on completely different plant species. So we need to think about habitat diversity and amplifying that as much as possible, and connectivity. And so indeed, butterflies, because of their visibility, have been used quite extensively in many climate change studies. They're excellent indicators because they respond so quickly to many different factors in the environment. So the role then is to try and identify what the specific factors are that are occurring on the prairies. These are our prairie canaries. So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I hope we can all work to advance the butterfly and pollinator conservation in general. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions if we have time.
I think we don't have the time, but I totally appreciate the work you're doing and helping to educate us. So thank you for coming and taking the time to be here.
Thank you, Madam.
Okay. We're now having the state agencies respond in talking about what we did last year. Obviously, we are just nibbling at the edges of the problem, but we started. And so we would like to hear from the state agencies. We have 3 state agencies and then 2 testifiers afterwards. So if you could limit your testimony to about 6 or so minutes, it would be appreciated. You can go fast. We listen fast.
Have I used up all my time yet?
Madam. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Welsh, Department of Natural Resources. I'm the Habitat Program Manager in the Division of Fish and Wildlife. I'm here to talk very quickly, apparently, about our progress that we've made on legislation that directed us to accomplish some things in the last session. Just to be clear, there's been a lot of discussion here today about honeybees, and Dr. Rundquist has shifted that a bit. And from the Department of Natural Resources standpoint, when we're talking about pollinators, we are talking about a broad range of insect pollinators, pollinators of flowering plants. And as managers in the Department of Natural Resources, we're talking about managing natural areas, primarily native plant communities. And within the Department of Natural Resources, we manage roughly 5.5 million acres of natural areas in the state of Minnesota, which is about 10% of the state. So that puts us in a unique position to provide refuge and value-added natural plant communities throughout the state. The challenge of that is that those 10% is not evenly distributed across the state. And I'll call your although this slide is looking at public ownership, all public ownership, so other agencies as well. It accounts for 25% of the land base in the state. Again, as you move south and west, the percent on the landscape dramatically decreases. So that so what you'll see in what I talk about in our direction to develop best management practices and guidelines on our lands, you'll see a very measured and deliberate emphasis on prairie because of this change in distribution across the landscape. Just real quickly, this is a reminder of the legislation that directed our actions. It's located 84.973 in statute, and there is the statute. I talked a little about the blue terms the last time I was here in December, so I won't go into those. The important thing here is that Section A directs best management practices and restoration guidelines in all habitats on lands controlled by the Commissioner of Natural Resources, and Section B is specific to prairie restoration and goes a step further in that it talks about lands controlled by the state lands, but also projects funded by with state funds. So let's get into those restoration guidelines and BMPs. Restoration guidelines are really we're really directing managers to be driven by the natural plant community. So we're really asking them to do a thorough analysis, a thorough assessment, and when they do go into a restoration project, to take into consideration the expected natural plant community in the area. So looking at things like soils, hydrology, the location in the state, pre-settlement habitat information, those types of things, to look for the predicted, the expected natural plant community and restore that. In addition, assessing the expected pollinators that would be associated with those plant communities. And then finally, our Division of Ecological Water Resources are developing a tool to help our managers with species lists to look at species. Now, I've violated the cardinal rule of 15 words on a slide here. I understand that, and I don't expect to be able to read this. But what this is just an example of one of those tools. That this is a list of the plants that would be expected on a northern mesic prairie. And what I call your attention to is some added columns that, as a result of this legislation, that are just indicators of the importance of these different species to pollinators from a forage standpoint, from a nest standpoint, nesting standpoint, and then also the time of year that they bloom. So that those will be made available to our managers as well. And now to get down into the weeds a little bit further, no pun intended, we looked at the activities that we do on natural plant communities. So what we did is we looked at our habitat enhancement work that we do and that has the potential of affecting pollinators, whether in a negative way or a positive way, and then look for ways to tweak them, provide best management practices to our managers to tweak them to minimize the negative impacts and accentuate the positive. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into these, but you got burning, mowing, grazing. On this page, I was going to kind of talk about the specifics, pesticide use, forest management, and then finally farming. Farming is one that we've kind of added since I talked to this group last time. Farming in itself isn't a treatment of a native plant community, but it is a tool that we use either in preparation for restoration, or oftentimes we use it perhaps alongside some of our natural plant communities as a wildlife management tool to provide food plots and things like that. And so there are things that that we're looking at with farming as well. The bottom line is that we're really looking at our activities as promoting diversity, as Dr. Rundquist previously said, and we didn't compare notes before we started, so thanks for that, Eric. But the bottom line is that diversity factor, and especially in the case of prairie, where we have declining postage stamps of habitat out there, so we really need to emphasize what we do on those pieces of property, and then really look to stack benefits, I guess is the terminology that we've come to use, and that our managers are realizing that pollinators are really our canary in the coal mine, and that if we do if we manage habitat well for pollinators, we're managing habitat well for all wildlife. And so where are we in our progress of our development of our best management practices? We've drafted the best management practices guidelines. That's been complete. We've completed the review process. The middle of February was our deadline to get comments back from cooperators and people interested. And now we're in the process of revising and incorporating comments. In fact, we just had a meeting two days ago to start rewriting that document to incorporate comments. And we hope to have that done and implement this growing season. And this is just a quick list of the people I'd like to thank for contributing comments. And with that, I'll take questions or move on, I guess.
I think we're going to have to hear now from Dan Shaw.
Okay.
But this is good. You are...
I will be here for the rest of the thing.
Super.
As well.
And you're certainly meeting the statute requirements.
Thank you.
Should we be doing more? Dan Shaw? Let's see. We want to make sure we have the time for other folks too. So,
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Dan Shaw from the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. So I'll be talking about efforts at our agency. So I'll be covering the context of the problem, talking about Bowser programs that assist pollinators and identified needs and actions that we're taking. Pollinators are definitely important for food production. They're also essential in sustaining ecosystems by providing seed and fruits for a wide range of wildlife species. It's estimated that they pollinate about 80% of our native plants, and so a key role in sustaining our ecosystem services. I'll go through this quickly. We've covered some of this before. Some of the context of the problem with honeybees, there's been seen about a 30% average mortality each year of hives for honeybees. Some of the key causes, different factors working together, pathogens, parasites, pesticides, poor nutrition. With native bees, the bumblebee declines have been one of the better documented cases. Several rare bumblebees in Minnesota. There's more information needed on our 350 to 400 Minnesota native bees, and so there's some research underway on that. Monarchs and many other species are at all-time lows. Eric covered that well, covering butterfly species. Causes here, habitat loss, pesticides, also loss of larval host plants, so things like milkweeds for monarchs, lupine for Carnegie blue butterflies, and so that's another key need in the landscape. We have different programs at the Board of Water and Soil Resources that have benefits to pollinators. One is wetland protection, administering the Minnesota Wetland Conservation Act, also restoring lost acres. And so we have about 16,000 acres of restored wetlands Typically using diverse mixes, our state seed mixes is what we recommend for these sites. Our rim conservation easements, about 250,000 acres restored, and then also soil and water conservation grants provide habitat for pollinators. So our discussion has been really focused on what can we do to be most effective in adapting our programs and aiding pollinators. And some of the key areas we've been talking about, looking at key partnerships and habitat programs, how to focus all of our BOSR programs on this topic, effective practices for Minnesota, how to benefit honeybees specifically, and then outreach and education efforts. One of the benefits of the recent legislation on pollinators is that it really brought the partners together. And so been a lot of discussions between agencies, different conservation groups, a lot of groups doing a lot of good things on pollinators right now. So I think there's a lot of momentum on this topic, and we're moving in a good direction. One of your handouts is a new sheet that we put together on incorporating pollinator habitat into Minnesota conservation programs. Try to make it easier for landowners to see what their options are as ways to get more pollinator habitat on their properties. As far as focusing on BOSR programs, we're looking at targeted habitat protection and restoration, trying to get pollinators into some of our site assessment and ranking criteria. We're developing a habitat assessment calculator that will be used as well. There's a lot of opportunities within different types of projects, whether it's a rain garden, a lakeshore, or a conservation planting like the picture at the bottom, of getting a lot of floral resources into these sites. And so that's what we're focusing on. In some cases, floral-rich plantings and maybe smaller parts of easements. We have vegetation guidelines that guide our projects, and so they set diversity levels. They also set a range for obtaining seeds and plants for projects, and that's the map on the right side. Using a science-based approach with ecological sections and subsections, we'll have bee species that are native to different ecological sections, and trying to find plants that are specific to those areas is important. Promoting projects that provide multiple landscape benefits. This is definitely a future of conservation, trying to combine things like carbon sequestration, water quality, in addition to pollinators. Promoting planting and maintenance methods that maintain diversity. Bob talked about this as well for DNR. So we're working this into our outreach materials, ways to be more effective in maintaining that diversity, because in some cases we can plant high diversity, but it may not last. And so we need to find ways to make sure that that will last. How to benefit honeybees. I grew up farming and raising bees, and so it's something that I feel very passionate about, and so we're looking for ways to benefit honeybees as well. And there's opportunities on our conservation easements to have hives, to have smaller planting plots that are species that benefit honeybees. There's research underway looking at what native species are most beneficial to honeybees. We've been busy working on a lot of different resources to guide projects. Some of these are plant ID resources. The Minnesota Wetland Restoration Guide, we're just finishing. It has a lot of detailed information on how to restore sites. Interseeding guidelines for increasing diversity on existing conservation lands that maybe have more of a grass focus. We also have a What's Working website where we get information from people working on our grants to try to learn from their experience so that we can become more effective, and we're adding pollinators as a key part of that. In the last round of state seed pollinators as a key part of that. In the last round of state seed mixes, we added more forb species, added more milkweed into mixes, regionalized them to make sure that the plants were regionalized. And this will be an ongoing process, trying to focus these mixes to really benefit pollinator species. We'll have in the future conservation grazing mixes and bioenergy mixes, native mixes, and so we'll be evolving this process as we move ahead. And to finish off, effective outreach and education efforts, we're starting a Minnesota Pollinator Proud campaign focused on looking at model projects. We can put them up on a website. We can do outreach with these model projects and promoting effective techniques, highlighting different partnerships through this campaign. And then final slide here, we have our Bowser feature plant. We have between 400 and 500 people signed up that get these monthly updates, and we've been featuring pollinator species through the last year, and then it's an opportunity for us to get our messages out to all these people that are getting these messages. Thank you.
Nice job.
Thank you.
Both in content and speed. So we'll bring up the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are on the on-deck circle in the interest of time. My name is Santo Cruz with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
I'm Matt Warman, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to join you today to talk about the important role of bees and other pollinators in our state and across the nation. I want to applaud you, Madam Chair, and Representative Poppe and the members of this committee for your leadership on this issue. Last session, this body took an unprecedented step to pass some of the first pollinator legislation in the country, and you should be applauded for that. We all know that pollinators are vitally important to our state and nation. Throughout Minnesota's 155 years of statehood, agriculture has been a bedrock of our economy. Today, our agricultural industry provides more than 340,000 jobs and $75 billion in economic activity. Our farmers are some of the best in the world at what they do. Quality, innovation, and plain hard work has allowed them to outperform the rest of the world. Minnesota farmers are also fortunate to have some of the most fertile soils anywhere in the world. Over many generations, our farmers have cared deeply about soil conservation and the quality of our ecosystem because they know that these good soils and the quality of our environment is a key ingredient to success of our agricultural system and the livelihood of their families. We also know that pollinators are an important part of our agricultural industry. Pollinators are as essential to reproduction of most native and cultivated crop plants as soil quality is to the growth and productivity of those plants. Bees and other pollinators play a critical role in the pollination process. Simply put, the well-being of our farm economy and the security of our nation's food supply depend in part on healthy pollinator populations. While there are more than 200,000 pollinator species worldwide, including insects, birds, bats, and other animals worldwide, insect pollinators such as bees, wasps, flies, and butterflies are some of the most critical to food production. However, bees are the most efficient and important pollinators for our food crops. Across the nation, the estimated annual value of honeybee pollination for food production is $15 to $18 billion, while that of native bees is around $3 billion. The actual benefits are likely much higher than this because pollinators are not well understood and not extensively studied. Regardless of the amount of economic impact, pollinators are very important to agriculture and our society. Due to these important contributions to our state, we are deeply concerned, Madam Chair, about the decline in populations of honeybees and other pollinators. At this time, the science tells us there is not a single cause behind pollinator declines, but instead there are multiple pressures, including pollinator pathogens and parasites, lack of foraging habitat, poor nutrition, pesticides, and the lack of genetic diversity, among others, that are impacting our pollinator communities and threaten their health. So while the science does not give us a definitive prescription to protect and enhance our pollinator communities, we know that there can be some concrete steps taken to help stabilize and enhance pollinators in Minnesota. First, we have the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, we have issued a commissioner's directive to our Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division to immediately begin a special registration review of neonicotinoid insecticides due to the concerns expressed about their impact on pollinator communities. Some of those concerns were expressed here today. Both federal and state laws govern the registration and use of neonicotinoids in Minnesota. However, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is the lead state agency for pesticide, environmental, and regulatory functions in Minnesota, and we take that responsibility very seriously. A special registration review provides the commissioner and stakeholders with scientific evaluation of Minnesota-specific pesticide products. This is a process that allows for stakeholders and public and the public to provide us feedback on the scope and recommendations of the study. There will be opportunities for public comment. Due to the complexity of this issue, it may take up to a year to complete this review. Based on the results of the review and the available science, the department has statutory authority to clarify label provisions or add additional restrictions to product to protect the environment if necessary, to develop BMPs for use and guidance for applicators to enhance product stewardship and other measures to protect human health and the environment. Second, it is clear that consumers are looking for more factual information about pollinators, habitat, and pesticides. The Department of Agriculture has developed three pollinator work groups, all of which have met in the past week. And I know that Catherine Sill sits on one of those advisory committees at the department. These groups are charged with developing best management practices to establish pollinator habitat in Minnesota. They're focused on three landscape types: agricultural lands, gardened and managed landscapes, and roadsides. The intent of these work groups is to develop best management practices that will be in place for consumers to get basic information, but also a link to more detailed information based on their interest. We expect that these work groups will have completed BMPs developed by midsummer. Third, at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, we've been working with a really good group of stakeholders, interested and engaged experts, to share information and review the latest research on pollinator issues. Due to the important significance of and the interest in pollinator issues, we want to continue these important discussions. Therefore, the department will organize and host an annual pollinator consortium that gathers representatives, industry and pollinator experts, stakeholders, legislators, and others to participate in reviewing the research, sharing information, and assist us in promoting best management practices that benefit pollinators. This venue will offer an opportunity for participants to share additional ideas on agency efforts and implementation, and offer ideas for legislative actions in the future if necessary. Fourth, I am pleased, Madam Chair, that Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced last week $3 million in funding for the NRCS EQIP program to focus on pollinators. This program will provide technical and financial assistance to help interested farmers and ranchers to install and enhance conservation practices that provide habitat and food resources for pollinators. For example, this funding will help install cover crops and other forage management practices, which not only help pollinators, but also have multiple benefits for water quality. This new funding is a focused investment to improve pollinator health and will be targeted to five Midwestern states, including Minnesota, Michigan, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. And just last night, I had a conversation with our state conservationist, Don Blone, and we look forward to working with him and his agency to help promote this to Minnesota farmers. Fifth, I understand that this body is considering support for a long-term pollinator research center at the University of Minnesota that will be equipped to explore the challenges and opportunities around pollinators in our state and around the country. I understand that there are various proposals for pollinator banks that warrant further review. The department supports efforts to expand our knowledge and understanding of pollinators, as well as the complex pressures that have threatened our pollinator communities. We know from our work in multiple areas of agriculture and the environment that strong scientific research can help the department develop best management practices that farmers can use to more effectively reach our desired outcomes. And last but not least, we take our pesticide investigation responsibilities very seriously. I know there was some discussion earlier about our work that we did on the Minneapolis bee kill and others. I'm proud to say that we have a group of highly trained inspectors and investigators at the department who have dedicated their careers to protecting the people of Minnesota. Many of them have over 20 years of experience in pesticide misuse investigations. When we get involved in these bee investigations, we use the best available resources we have, whether that means collaborating with a USDA laboratory on the East Coast or obtaining knowledge from experts in our own backyard at the University of Minnesota. Madam Chair, members, again, this is a very important issue for our farm economy and the security of our state and nation's food supply. I want to thank you for all the time you've provided today on this issue. I look forward to our continued work together on these issues, and we'll stand for any questions you may have.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to recognize a person who worked very tirelessly, I think, behind the scenes. That was Representative Paul Torkelson. He needs to have recognition for the work he did to help us in the effort to begin the pollinator legislation. And it's become maybe more than he even imagined or had in mind, but he does deserve some recognition, and I just wanted to highlight that today.
Thank you. That was very appropriate, and I appreciate that. Are there questions for my members? I particularly appreciate your annual conference. That is something I had not heard about before, and that is, I think, going to be important for Minnesotans to hear about, So because of the opportunity it presents. So. I don't see any other questions. I think one of the issues that we need to have a continued conversation about is one of the things that was highlighted in the testimony here, and people coming to my office say again and again, farmers don't have a choice about seed purchase. They have to purchase seed that has been treated. And clearly, there are farmers who want to make a different choice and cannot do so. So that is a discussion that I think we need to have, not right this minute, but it is a discussion we need to have.
Madam Chair, if I may, and members of the committee, one of the things I wanted to mention, not necessarily on the rural agricultural issue of systemic neonicotinoid uptake into plants, but I'm aware of a bill that's been put forth regarding truth in labeling, really, about from nursery plants for urban areas. And I had a conversation with Government Affairs Director Tim Powers of the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, and the department and the association will be looking to support that effort in making sure that there is plants that aren't advertised as bee-friendly if, in fact, that is not the case and that the systemic uptake of pesticides that may be present, the consumer is aware of that.
That's good news. Thank you. I expect there will be. Representative Dabney was here today. He is a beekeeper. I don't know whether, and that is why he was here today. He will have legislation on limiting or giving some opportunities for cities of the first class to do some work in their own areas that they opportunities they don't have right now. Representative Anderson.
Just a quick comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the earlier testifiers mentioned pesticide spraying in the metro area. I'd just like to make a clarification that at least in rural areas for agricultural spraying, when the co-op comes out to my farm, they have a 2- or 3-page form they fill out. They list the chemical, the exact rate per acre, the temperature, wind speed, and if the wind speed exceeds the label direction, they don't spray that day. So agricultural spraying is heavily monitored, and it's done very carefully.
Thank you, and I think something is lacking in the metro area. I think you are highlighting that, and I appreciate that. We have some public testimony, and I would like to take, so thank you all. We look forward to additional conversations because they must be had.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
First, Lex Horan, then Judy Chucker, and then Julia Vanetta. We're going to have to be fairly rapid here, but I do appreciate your coming and your attention to this.
Excellent. Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lex Horan, and I work with Pesticide Action Network of North America. And our work at Pesticide Action Network focuses on replacing the use of hazardous pesticides with ecologically sound and socially just alternatives. We were founded in 1982, and since then we've been working with policymakers and communities impacted by pesticides towards a food system that's safe and healthy for all of us. I'll begin with a brief mention. In 2012, Pesticide Action Network published a State of the Science report summarizing the latest scientific research on the linkages between pesticides and bee declines. I won't dig into that in depth given our time constraints, but I would like to emphasize the main finding of that report after a thorough survey of the science that was available at that time was that we were reaching a point of scientific consensus that pesticides are a driving factor of declining bee populations. So, for example, research tells us that when bees are exposed to multiple pesticides at once, it often produces a synergistic effect that leads to higher bee mortality than one pesticide on its own. When bees are exposed to high levels of systemic insecticides, we can see entire hives lost suddenly, as we heard about this morning. But at sublethal doses, neonicotinoids and other pesticides still have worrisome impacts on bees that can decrease their survival. So at field realistic levels, neonicotinoids are known to interfere with bees' ability to navigate and forage and impair memory. Bees become less mobile after exposure to low doses of neonicotinoids, etc. One last piece of research I'd like to point to that is, I think, very interesting given our conversation this morning about alternatives is a forthcoming paper from Christian Krupke at Purdue University. And this paper isn't published yet, but his research is beginning to indicate that there may actually be no significant yield differences between seeds treated with neonicotinoids and untreated seeds for corn in particular. And speaking of alternatives, I think that many traditional IPM practices are important places to begin in terms of alternatives to neonicotinoid use. So particularly use of cover crops and crop rotation and beneficial insects, as we discussed this morning. But I think this question about alternatives also points to an important issue around research, that research on alternatives has been dwarfed by research that is funded by the pesticide industry, whose aim is to defend neonicotinoids in particular. So I think that there's a need for increased research to resource farmers to use alternatives to this class of pesticides. So I'd like to move now. The Minnesota House and multiple state agencies have already taken very important steps to address the problem of pollinator declines in our state. And not all states can be commended for taking this kind of action. But we are also in very good company in our state. We're seeing this happen across the country. There are bills in New York and Oregon and California, particularly to address the issue of neonicotinoids and bees. So as many of our speakers already this morning have mentioned, there are a number of excellent policy options available, and I'd like to just touch on a few of those.
I think we need to end this now because we do have other people, and while we have gone over time, folks are going to need to get to the next committee.
Sure, absolutely.
And so I appreciate this, but if you would write this down, we will post it on our website.
Certainly. Will
which
do.
Is our protocol. It's our normal
Great.
Protocol.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Judy Chucker from St. Louis Park, if you could... We have 5 minutes, and I understand somebody else wants to say something, so we'll just be really quick.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your commitment and leadership on this issue. My name is Judy Chucker, and I'm from St. Louis Park. I'm a volunteer with Minnesota Audubon and also with a group called Humming for Bees, but I'm not speaking for them, speaking for myself. While the seriousness of the decline of pollinators can't be underestimated, our framing of the problem needs to be enlarged. In doing so, our understanding of what's at stake will be improved. I'm referring to the lethal effects that neonics have on birds and the aquatic systems upon which they depend. You have probably already learned that the EPA's decision process in granting registration of these products is deeply flawed, and I would go so far as to say it was negligent. A single kernel of corn coated with neonics can kill a bird the size of a blue jay. And I'm quoting now from the American Bird Conservancy, which issued a report a year ago. Even a tiny grain of wheat or canola treated with imidacloprid can poison a bird. And as little as 1/10 of a corn kernel per day during egg-laying season is all that is needed to affect reproduction with any of the neonics. Studies here in Canada and elsewhere in the world would reveal, quote, strikingly high neonic contamination of our surface and groundwater beyond the threshold found to kill many aquatic invertebrates. The EPA not only underestimated this risk, they used, quote, scientifically unsound, outdated methodology that had more to do with a game of chance than with a rigorous scientific process, unquote. Major concerns and warnings were ignored, and yet here we are talking about setting up buffer zones and putting on improved labeling. Unfortunately, better labeling will not prevent a bird from foraging for that one coated seed that will kill it. Here's what the American Bird Conservancy suggested that the EPA be urged to do, and what I ask you to bear in mind to preserve the problem's big picture. Again, this is what the American Bird Conservancy is asking of the EPA. Suspend all applications of neonics pending independent review of these products' effects on birds, terrestrial and aquatic invertebrates, and other wildlife. Expand its re-registration review of neonics beyond bees to include birds, aquatic invertebrates, and other wildlife. Ban the use of neonics as seed treatments and require that registrants of acutely toxic pesticides develop the tools necessary to diagnose poison birds and other wildlife. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for adding that perspective. It was important. Julia Veneta. Now we're down to 2 minutes and two people.
Thank you for the 2 minutes. I'll take one if I can. My name is Julia Veneta. I live and work in Minneapolis part-time at a small hardware store. I'm also co-founder of Pollinator Revival, an organization working to educate store owners about the products on their shelves. This is an important issue because the consumer needs to know what they're buying. I became interested in pollinator conservation as I began to learn more about the balance of nature, how plants, insects, birds, other wildlife, and humans are all linked together, and when we disturb, harm, or destroy even one small part, we all suffer. And I applaud the efforts of the Healthy Bees, Healthy Lives campaign for bringing this issue forward to help us regain regulation and control of pesticide use where we live. Even the most immediate government action, however, will not help the customer who walks into our store or any lawn and garden center this summer. Product labels on pesticides are designed to sell the manufacturer's solution to Japanese beetle or emerald ash borers. Cautions are rarely stated in a user-friendly language, which leads consumers begging for answers from store clerks like myself with only a few minutes and limited knowledge of the active ingredients used. These inert ingredients are often proprietary and only available to a doctor after exposure, so we, the consumer, are not protected. The new labeling that they're recommending is good, but it's going to take years for it to reach the shelves, and there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of gallons of these products in the shelves. We don't have years, and our communities and urban environments need to have the ability to protect, because we, in the urban environment, can actually be more healthy for bees than out in the agricultural fields. So bring the bees and the butterflies into our cities and conserve them here and make our urban cities an oasis of habitat. Thank you.
Thank you. An oasis of habitat. Members, did you hear that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me speak. I'm Victoria Ranawa. I'm a beekeeper in rural Shakopee in Prior Lake. I have over 100 hives. I'm also the farm manager of a market farm that grows fruits and vegetables. I just want to quickly touch on non-lethal doses of bees or of pesticides that are toxic to bees. So I have suffered bee kills in my hives, but really what's really disconcerting to me are those non-lethal doses. When I go into my hive, and I know you guys can't see this, but these are baby bees that are not capped. And so what the adult bees are supposed to do is cap over these cells before the bee metamorphosizes into an adult bee. I'm not supposed to see these white faces looking at me, but they are looking at me because the adult bees were like zombies when I went into this hive. They weren't doing their job because they were poisoned. They didn't die outright, but they weren't doing their job. So they're not doing their job tending that future generation. They're not out there gathering pollen and nectar. So as a beekeeper, I'm losing honey production. I'm losing the health of my hive where they can't winter properly because they don't have enough bees because the adults weren't taking care of them because they were poisoned. I've also seen bumblebees twitching in my yard. I don't use pesticides, but somebody else in my yard. We've watched bumblebees twitch in our yard for like 2 hours, not even doing a normal thing that a queen bumblebee should do in the spring. And when that queen bumblebee can't do her job of foraging for pollen and nectar and incubating her hive, that's essentially the death of the hive. So even though she physically didn't die, it's the same thing. So I see that we're running out of time. So I just want you guys to think of that when you're making your decisions.
Thank you so much for coming. Members, I just want to announce one other thing. There has been a poll done looking at various things of concern to the public. It's a widely, it was a large poll. We're going to post it on our website because it tells us that from the public's point of view, the first environmental issue that people are concerned about is drinking water. That's not surprising to any of us who've worked in this area. The second concern is pollinators. That's a surprise, and it was a surprise to the pollster. We will post it on our website. Thanks so much for coming, members. Meeting adjourned.